Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to Week, the political roundtable program from the Commonwealth Club of California for Friday, February 21st, 2014. Thank you for joining us today. I'm John Zipperer, the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial, and your host for today's program. As always, we'll try to provide some insight into some of the most important issues of the past couple weeks. And any opinions expressed here are those solely of the speakers and not necessarily of the Commonwealth Club, its members, supporters, or guests. Let's meet our panelists for today. Starting at the other end of the stage, Dr. Larry Gersten is a professor of political science at San Jose State University. He's also a political analyst at NBC Bay Area and the author of Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California. You can follow him on Twitter at lgersten.com. Next to him is Deborah J. Saunders, a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, where she also writes the token conservative blog at sfgate.com. She's on Twitter as Deborah J. Saunders. And last but not least, representing the 99%, is C.W. Nevius, a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and someone you can follow as C.W. Nevius on Twitter. So please use the question cards that are spread throughout the room to write down your questions, submit them. I'll try to answer ask as many of them as we can today. Now, on to our roundtable, and I want to start with something that hits kind of close to home here at the Commonwealth Club. We're just a little bit more than a week away from the Academy Awards, so it's a timely season for me to take a couple minutes to note the recent passing of a film icon, Shirley Temple Black. People like my mother remember her as a young star, and my mother was thrilled as a little girl when people saw her curly red hair and said she looked like Shirley Temple. I guess today they would want to look like Justin Bieber. But later generations, of course, got to know Shirley Temple Black, the former child star who became a diplomat, serving as an ambassador to Ghana and Czechoslovakia. She even ran for the U.S. Congress as a conservative Republican in the late 1960s, losing to Pete McCloskey. Here at the Commonwealth Club, we have even more to be thankful for when it comes to Shirley Temple Black. She joined the club in 1971, one of the first women to do so. And she also became one of the first women to serve as president of the Commonwealth Club, a role she performed in 1984. One of the things she championed during her presidency at the club was to find a permanent home for the club, so we weren't renters, but we could actually own our own building. And along those lines, in fact, as a legacy of her dedication to that goal, she designated the Commonwealth Club as one of just two organizations to receive gifts in her memory, something we're very thankful for. She was also instrumental in reaching across ideological lines. She personally convinced Cesar Chavez to give his speech here at the Commonwealth Club. In 1984, he gave a landmark speech that you can still find online, and many places still noting how she personally convinced him to make this address. We certainly do our best to continue her legacy by reaching out to people of different views and backgrounds, by finally bringing to fruition her dream of a permanent home for the club, and by continuing to have lively discussions like this of events and ideas and policies that affect us all. So just wanted to note her passing and all that she has meant to this club. So let's move on to our first topic then, and that is money in California races. I'm going to throw this right over to Larry because we've seen candidates at Ro Khanna, Meg Whitman, and others whose coffers are filled with money earned in the tech world, and then they go into politics. Ron Conway, certainly folks in San Francisco who follow politics are very familiar with his name. He's one of the leading tech voices in the Bay Area, and he says he hopes that these tech industry people who go into politics can actually push policy to make it more friendly toward the tech industry. Certainly there are others who think that that policy is already too friendly to such businesses. But let's talk about tech money in the California 2014 races. Larry, where do you see it? What role do you think it's going to play?
It's going to be there. There's no question about it. Along with a lot of other money. Let's not lose sight of the fact that money comes just pouring into races these days from everywhere. Mm-hmm. The tech money is yet another example of an industry that has come into its own in a big way, and with that, the pioneers, you know, have lots of money to spend. Zuckerberg spending $1 billion, you know, on philanthropy last year alone. So it's not just politics. Like a lot of things, I think we have to put it in its place. I'm not one of these people. I get in trouble all the time. I'm not on a lot of things. I'm not one of these people who get scared of a lot of money in politics. To me, the Citizens United case didn't really bother me. What bothered me about that case, and what bothered me to this day, is that when all this money is aflush, it needs to be accounted for. We use this word transparency, and it is missing. And as long as there's transparency, let the money go and let the voter beware or respond accordingly. Steyer said, I'm throwing out $100 million this year. And he's already had meetings with people asking them to match it. And I suspect that will, in some ways, offset some of the money that the liberals have been, you know, grousing about from the Koch brothers and others across the country. And, you know, sometimes we sort of like panic, you know, but just ask Meg Whitman, you know, how well her $150 million worked for her.
Yeah.
If you're a flawed candidate, you're a flawed candidate.
I completely agree with what Larry just said.
That's it.
I'm sorry, Larry. It's right. If people complain about money in politics, you can't keep money out of politics any more than you can keep rain from running down a hill, water from running down a hill. It's just...
If you can find it.
There. Yes, if you can find it. Well, that used to be true. The thing is... While I think that rich people have a right to spend their money to make their points, it's not seemly when they do too much of it. And that's what happened to Meg Whitman. People didn't think, oh, isn't this great? Meg Whitman cares so much about the state that she wants to spend all this money. People resented it. Tom Steyer is about to spend $100 million on his for NextGen on global warming. And I'll tell you something. There are environmentalists who aren't particularly happy about it. And there are other people who are looking at this thinking this is really more ego than it is policy. And it can backfire. So when the excesses happen, it doesn't redound to the benefit of the big money donor. And it doesn't necessarily work. I mean, money can make a difference for an initiative, and it does. But in terms of the big races, it doesn't.
Well, I'm somewhat concerned about the money, I have to say, in politics. I don't know what you do with it. The tech companies have been in a funny situation because at first they were criticized for not doing enough. You know, all you're doing is creating your apps. You're not getting involved in anything. Now they're getting involved, but their culture is such they are so accustomed to keeping themselves in a silo. It's very hard to get anything out of them, whatever they do. Even their philanthropic contributions sometimes are not very well publicized, and they're still getting hit for some of these things. That concerns me. My son, when he got out of school, worked for the Gill Foundation, which was founded by Tim Gill, who's a software designer. He's based in Denver. And they very strategically decided to look at house races across the United States that where the house was close, where it was very close to an even split, and try to pour money into specific candidates to flip the house. Now, I get that, and I think that's a good idea, as long as it supports my view. But it's also a very insider drill down kind of an idea, and it makes me a little uneasy, you know, that they can control the agenda in that way. Most of the tech companies, I think, are making some great contributions, but you know, there's people who would disagree and people who wonder about the Koch brothers as well.
Yeah, I think we need to be careful, Chuck. Tech, what does tech mean? I think the tech we're talking about now is really in that social media area, which is the latest wave. I remember going back 30 years ago when Silicon Valley was dying. All these companies were out there getting trounced by Japan and Korea. And so they started the joint venture Silicon Valley. That was part of that mess. And it was phenomenal. And with that, they finally realized what to many of us is obvious. Oh, my gosh, we've been spending so much time, you know, doing R&D, trying to make payroll, trying to find our own way. Holy smokes, we need some things from government, R&D money, H-1B workers, whatever it might be. And you know, the light went on, and suddenly they organized, and they began being active politically and philanthropically. And a lot of this has to do with just maturation, you know, of the industry. And I think we're seeing this now with tech. And it's clumsy with social media. It's so clumsy. Look what they're doing to San Francisco. And, you know, Ed Lee's got some responsibility for this.
Who was a tech candidate, frankly.
Well, you know,
a lot of money from Ron Conway and a lot of the same people that are doing the Okada.
Yeah.
And my question on that is, do you think he's going to, could the backlash that you see rumblings of, to mix metaphors, against him and the Ron Conway connection and all the tech giveaways, do you think that could threaten him in his reelection?
It very well may. You know, and look, you've already seen hints, you know, with this initiative that was defeated a couple of months ago on Washington, was it?
Now we're
talking about
the waterfront.
I guarantee you that's going to go down. This is, as much as anything else, a reaction to this new group that has sort of like insinuated itself on the old. It's a clash of cultures. And you know, it will settle at some point. But for the time being, it's very, very awkward.
Let's add another thing. There's a lot of resentment going on in the city right now because we're in the middle of a bubble. And everybody knows that the prices are going to go up like this, and it's going to send people out of the city. It's going to, and the prices are, certain things are going to become more expensive. And then it's going to drop. And it's going to be ugly. We've seen this so many times before, it makes us cynical. And so the reason, there is a certain sort of progressive liberal class envy element to hating the Google buses. And I think it's going too far. I think a lot of people are starting to side with the Google buses because they don't want all those Google kids in their cars.
Those Google kids.
They're kids to me. Kids to you, too. They don't want all those Google
too
kids.
Too much information.
Yeah,
kids.
That's right. So I think that, and Ed Lee's in the middle of this. Here he is. On the one hand, he'd be insane to tell high-tech people, go someplace else and make your money, because the revenue is good for the city. You get higher property taxes when
San Jose is saying, hey, we'll take it.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, on the other hand, those of us who aren't getting rich on this are looking at it thinking, we know what's going to happen next. And there are a lot of people who are going to get caught in the middle and hurt.
Well, one of my favorite columnists, is writing something tomorrow. I'm just saying, I mean, as much as we've attacked the Google kids and the Google buses and so forth, well, what if they leave? Mm-hmm. What if they say, you know what, we moved here, we thought it'd be great. We thought the employees would love it. Turns out they're getting harassed, they're getting hassled, they're getting stopped. You know, Rick Perry was in town, it was in San Jose a year ago, and said, come on down to Texas, the tax rate is nothing, there's plenty of room, and believe me, we're not going to give you any problems with your tech money. We'd be happy to have you. We had a story in the Chronicle the other day that the Excelsior District, just a few blocks down from Mission, which is ground zero for all. We'd love to have you. Oakland would like to have you. Berkeley would love to have you. San Jose would love to have you. So be careful, I think, what you wish for. And I think it's still a smaller group that is complaining about this. And it comes back down to housing and affordability, which I think we get it. That's definitely an issue. So we're working on that. But the idea of somehow transferring this to a bus is a little silly.
And Chuck, I think you'd agree the irony is that the answer to the housing boom that's making housing so expensive is to have more housing.
It's to build housing.
It's to build more housing. And Unfortunately, the same people who are trying to stop the Google buses and are against 8 Washington and everything else, they don't want more housing. So there's it's not really consistent.
I don't think it's they don't want more housing. I think it's where the housing is. I think that's more the issue on that. And I think this is also a problem of where the industry comes in, and kudos, by the way, to the mayor for attracting these guys. I think that's wonderful. Whether he's getting back from them enough is another story. I've got issues there. But more than that, it's one thing to format a building, move in 500 people or 1,000 people. That can be done like that. The housing is 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the street.
That can't be done like that in this city. You have to go to so many boards and commissions.
It is
not funny.
It's going to be done a lot sooner than the housing. That's my point.
I mean, I have to say, the thing I like about the tech culture is they don't believe in waiting 10 years to get something done. I don't like the fact that the Google barge just went up out of nowhere when nobody else could get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, the fact that if somebody wants to build a housing and they have to go to the planning commission, they can get the approval of the supervisors. As Chuck, you wrote a great column on that on 8 Washington.
Right.
They go through all the hoops and do everything right, and then they get told they can't finish building something. If people want cheaper housing here, they've got to change that, and they've got to make the connection in their minds.
Yeah, I think that's true. And the housing that we probably need in San Francisco, because it's a relatively small area, is dense. And people don't want dense housing. And this initiative, as Larry said, this waterfront height initiative has got wide-ranging consequences. Whether you support it or not, you have to remember that this can go all the way down to Pier 70. The area where the Giants want to build sort of a little civic center south of the ballpark, that area right now is zoned for the height of zero. Technically, it's open space, and that means really you shouldn't have anything larger, higher than a blade of grass. So
we can go underground.
We can go underground. That's right. We'll have an underground city. That's what we'll do. Actually, watching them build the ballpark, as soon as they went down 14 feet, the hole filled up with water. The water table is so high that you probably couldn't do that either. Anyway, the point is, so many of these things sound great in theory. Let's don't Manhattanize San Francisco. Let's don't get carried away with this building. But the result of that has been not enough housing, and the people that are in housing stay in housing. They don't move up because if they have rent control, this is the place I want to stay. And there should be this gradual, it's disputed, but there should be this gradual trickle-up idea. And it's not happening. Those people don't have a place to go.
Before we move on, Mayor Lee here in San Francisco has obviously tried to get ahead of some of this. He's talked about trying to build or rehabilitate 30,000 units of affordable housing or housing affordable to certain levels of income. How do you think he's doing? I mean, is he doing all he can, or is he missing what's causing the ire?
It's tough, as Deborah said. And the other thing that we have to keep in mind is affordable housing in San Francisco. I live down by the ballpark. We bought a place down by the ballpark. We had a community meeting, and they said, now they're building apartments across the way. That'll be affordable housing. And this guy raised his hand and said, well, I don't know if I want those people here, okay? And they said, you realize affordable housing is $600,000. You know, we're not talking about, you know, public assistance here. Affordable housing in San Francisco is still a tough nut to crack. It's going to be difficult to get into those houses. So he's got a lot of work to do. We need more units. This whole Bayview thing is going to be really interesting to follow. And Treasure Island is going to be another place that will be interesting to follow. But there isn't any getting around what Deborah said. They have to build.
We need a bunch of Google barges that people can live in.
Right.
That's probably what Google was actually planning on doing.
I'm sure that
doing.
Was their intention.
Even though they haven't told us, even though they're so transparent.
Well, speaking of money, we're actually speaking to you, sitting on a stage here that has hosted people of a wide variety of views. And just last week, in fact, right where I am, venture capitalist Tom Perkins was here. He was discussing at length his contention that there is a class war being waged against the so-called 1%. And then earlier this week, Senator Barbara Boxer was here. She was right over there on your left.
Appropriate.
Totally coincidental. And though she didn't directly address Perkins, she was certainly responding to some of the same issues, and of course her approaches were different than the ones he was suggesting. So I actually want to start with Chuck here, because you played a not inconsequential role in ticking off Mr. Perkins to begin with, and in his famous letter to the Wall Street Journal that we discussed at our last week to week. So could you maybe give us some background for anyone who
is
sleeping?
If you weren't following that, first of all, thank you, Mr. Perkins, for my 15 minutes of fame. I appreciate it. John King, our architecture critic, wrote something about the Spreckles Mansion, which is owned by Danielle Steele. And Danielle Steele was married. Perkins was husband number 6. I'm not really sure, but they were married. John noticed that there's an enormous hedge in front of Spreckles Mansion, which blocks a lot of the mansion. You can't really see it. And he called it comically off-putting. And then after that...
Those are fighting words.
Evidently, they are. Our Miss Bigelow was at a society event and said something about it, and Danielle Steele made this remark about, I can't believe people care about my hedge. You know, they must think I'm a big snob. So I wrote what I thought was a whimsical blog post about how, you know, hey, Danielle, lighten up a little bit here. You know, if you didn't want people to look in your windows, don't buy an enormous mansion in the center of San Francisco. And by the way, have you ever heard of curtains as opposed to an enormous hedge? And then I quoted her as saying that years ago, or she said, I guess in the last year in Paris, that the people in San Francisco dress like they're going camping. You can't have any style in San Francisco. So I may have referred to her as a bit of a snob. And then we got a 3-page typewritten letter from Danielle Steele explaining why she was not a snob. So then I wrote another blog post saying, I can't believe I got a fan letter from Danielle Steele. And that was the last straw for Tom Perkins. So he wrote this letter to the Wall Street Journal in which he, first of all, attacked the San Francisco Chronicle for being despicable and mean, and then somehow veered, which I think is a trend with Tom, veered off to another topic, which was how the 1% in this country are actually experiencing the same kind of persecution that happened to the Jews in Nazi Germany. And as he said on this stage, that turned out to be the most read letter in the history of the Wall Street Journal. It went everywhere. It was unbelievable. So that's kind of where we are.
Yes. The good news for you two is that this shows that someone's reading the Chronicle.
Someone is reading the Chronicle. That's right.
Probably the paper version of it.
And by the way, I know John Diaz, the editorial page editor, will want people to know that when Danielle Steele sent that letter and reran her piece in our open forum section. But I think that sometimes when people have a lot of money, they feel like everyone should act like they work for them. And they apparently felt so even though Danielle Steele got to vent rather fully
at length
in our paper about the harsh treatment, and I mean, what did you say? It was comically...
John King said it was comically off-putting.
This really has gotten into them. And by the way, the other thing that Mr. Perkins said that people found questionable was that Danielle Steele is the number one celebrity in San Francisco.
That's right.
The people at the SF Gate have had lots of fun
with. Ran a poll. We ran through all that stuff.
I
don't want to dominate, but I would say just in passing that I did write to Tom Perkins after the letter came, and I said, you know, actually, why don't we sit down for a cup of coffee? And he invited me to his penthouse down the street here.
To clean it, yes.
No, he didn't. Said, I'm looking for someone to drive my car. Would you be interested in the job? No, he was very nice. And I said, we'd like to have a cup of coffee. And he said, can we make it Irish coffee? And I said, that would be fine. And we had an Irish coffee and a very nice time. He insisted that be completely off the record. But he was very nice.
Now, last time we talked about this, we kind of went in depth about that actual Wall Street Journal and the outrageousness of his comparison. So I don't want to rehash that, but I do think it's important to note that many conservatives, including our own Deborah J. Saunders, took Perkins to task for that. So
it's never a good idea to compare people who disagree with you to Nazis unless they are Nazis. if they are genocidal, you can do it.
Yes.
Otherwise, it's a bad idea.
Well, and this, did you? I didn't know this until this happened, but apparently there's a theorem that some guy has come up with. That is, in any discussion, if it continues long enough, someone will compare someone to the Nazis. It's just going to happen. That's all there is to it. It's always the go-to. At some point, you go to the Nazis. Yeah.
Then let's veer this away from that.
Okay.
But let's talk about some of his general complaints, because I think there might be many who disagreed, again, with the words he used, but still think he has a serious point about how people are attacking, you know, the 1%, and I think or just people who they think represents that movement. And I think the Google buses is an example of that. So
he made a great point about the fact that, I mean, okay, so I've sort of not said nice things about people with a lot of money and how they treat other people, but it's a mistake to decide that all of my woes are because of them. And again, we were talking earlier about how Mayor Ed Lee wants to have the tech money here. The truth is, these are people you want to live in your community, and he was right to say that you should not, what is it that you do, kill the goose that lays the golden eggs. He made some great points, but...
there's an app for that, actually.
Yeah. But if, you know, if you want to get people to think about those things, it's a good idea to not treat them as if they were pesky little rodents who criticized your ex-wife's hedge.
Right, minions that you sort of do.
Yeah.
Well, Larry probably has more to say about this, but the point that he kept making, he made it here and he made it when I spoke to him privately, was that especially when President Obama goes on the air and says we need to have the rich pay their fair share, he found that as an attack, and his point was, I'm already paying. You wouldn't believe how much I am paying. And of course, in California, that's really true. He's paying a lot of taxes. Now, is he still a multi-millionaire? Absolutely. Is his lifestyle just absolutely scrumptious? It is. It's wonderful. This penthouse and look at this view. But I could see where somebody would say, do you have any idea how much I'm paying in taxes? Now, saying that, how many people in the room say, that is terrible. I feel awful about that. We're not that sympathetic, and I think that's the point he's missing. No, oh, you're right.
But there's an underlying issue here that, you know, it's a lot of fun and pointing out ridiculous comparisons and, okay, that'll take us a little distance, but the fundamental fact is that, you know, we're seeing tremendous chasm developing between the top and the bottom. The middle's falling out. I mean, there's so many ways of identifying this issue. And, you know, it percolates in sometimes interesting ways, like what should we do about the minimum wage? How should we change it? And the states are taking the lead on that much more than the federal government. There's a problem here. We're not addressing it. I don't think the problem is as simple as just increasing the tax on the wealthy. I do think, and I'm writing about this right now, so it's all in my head, that this whole issue of loopholes and exemptions and subsidies. Boeing is going to be forgiven for $8 billion from the state of Washington. $8 billion so that they will manufacture the 787 Dreamliner there. Well, that's good. Wonderful. We like that. And of course the theory always is, well, all these people will be working and they'll pay it back and then some. But they don't.
It does not always happen.
They rarely do. And in fact, more times than not, the company that gets the subsidy walks away. It's not working. Volkswagen walked away from $3 billion in Pennsylvania and came back. Okay? So, I mean, those are the kinds of things that I think we need to think about. Not so much changing rates or whatever, but we're talking about some... And when you forgive that $8 billion... one of two things happens. You've lost $8 billion in programs and services, or someone else is going to pay for it.
Well, I mean, that's happening right here. Look at what happened with Twitter. And I have to say, philosophically, I am 1,000% opposed to it. But on a practical level, I think it worked. I think that we have, you know, the mid-market has been such a pit. And sometimes you have to do creative things you don't like, because it really is in the interest of the city.
How many times have we tried to do something?
Interest in the city or interest in some people in the city? I mean, look, I'm not against building. Mm-hmm. I'm not against industry. I'm not against any of that stuff. It's important. It's good. But there's got to be, and I'll use the word that others have used, there's got to be some fairness here. And that's where we lose it.
Well, I get that. But as someone who walks from the Chronicle to City Hall and walks along that mid-market...
And that is the worst walk in the city.
That is an embarrassment. The idea that a city that has $8 billion a year in tourist dollars, that between our prime shopping area and our City Hall is this awful eyesore, which is not only ugly and terrible and boarded up shops, but has some people who are desperately in need of help, you know, mentally ill, drug addicted. The idea that we have to do something to do that, and this is the first thing that's worked. We've tried, I can't tell you how many different things we've done. All well-intentioned, all well-funded, great ideas, this worked. We got those businesses in there. It's working because they're working.
There's got to be payback.
Yeah.
There's got to be payback.
There's going to be a loss. I understand almost $2 million we've lost in tax revenue so far through 2012. I'd pay that. If we can clean up mid-market, I'm in favor of it.
We've paid that for things that didn't work before.
Yes, that's true.
That's the thing. And, Larry, I completely agree with you on the large issue. I would love to see Barack Obama move across the aisle to work with Republicans to lower tax rates but get rid of a bunch of the loopholes. That would be so great for this country, so great for this economy. It would deal with some of the plutocracy issues that all of us have that we see in government, it would be the swellest thing in the world.
It's all in the headline, because someone else could say, Deborah,
Who would say that?
I would love to see those congressional Republicans move across and talk to the president and get serious about blah, blah, blah.
And they have made proposals.
And
before.
The Democrats would say, and I've just, I'm just a spectator here, the Democrats would say,
are they supposed to
they
go over to the White House uninvited?
I think there's room for blame on both sides here. There really is. I don't believe that the Republicans are total obstructionists, and I don't believe that the president has his head in the sand. But I do think it's a mistake to point a finger at one side and not the other. I just do.
I'm glad we were able to get you two disagreeing again.
It was kind of concerning.
Yeah. You know, I think the point you made earlier about the gulf between the haves and the have-nots is not only national, but this is ground zero for that. I think there's a reason so many people are folk. We're getting so many stories, and people are all sending. They're sending the guy out there, parachuting him into San Francisco. Tell us what's going on out there. It's this whole culture war thing. Well, what's really happening is, and David Campos has run on a Tale of Two Cities. I think at the base and the bottom of this entire culture war is that people are moving away from each other, and as Larry said, the middle is not holding. The middle is leaving.
So can I follow your example, Chuck, and mention my Sunday column? I hope you
your favorite columnist.
My favorite columnist has it about the gap and the fact that the gap just raised the minimum wage.
Yeah.
And I actually said San Francisco's ground zero for this whole thing. And here's the irony. So here you have the San Francisco company that announced that it doesn't matter what Washington's doing, they're going to raise their minimum wage to $9 an hour starting in this summer, and then up to $10 an hour the following year, and it won't apply in San Francisco because the minimum wage here is already over $10 an hour, and it won't apply in California has a bill that is going to raise the minimum wage not quite as quickly for that $10 amount 6 months later, so it's sort of ironic that you see the San Francisco company doing something that I think is in its financial interest to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand how they can get by in those stores hiring people at minimum wage.
Well, and as they say,
a lot of stores that have low-paid people, and then they also have to subsist on public assistance for part of it.
Let's remember, they've got 65,000 employees. So you're right.
No, they've got 65,000 who will benefit from this. They have 95,000, about 90,000.
Okay.
This is they
Would
have about 90,000.
I'm sorry, you're bickering like this.
They have about 90,000 employees in the United States.
Yeah.
So
65,000 will benefit from
that. That means a lot of people working at the Gap are, you know, in the bottom.
Sure. Well, making the minimum wage and selling $80 shirts. I mean, it's got to be difficult. You encounter it every day.
Chuck, you have to go there when they're having a sale.
I have to think that some of the people working there are there for the discounts.
I think that's the benefit everyone gets of working in the store like that. I have a question, and raising the minimum wage is an issue that obviously, in California, they're looking at President Obama is talking about, and Barbara Boxer, of course, came here earlier this week, and she was proposing it. Show of hands, who thinks we should raise the national minimum wage? And that was most hands, but not all. Anyone actually thinks we should not raise the minimum wage?
Don't be afraid to raise your hand.
Someone's going to follow you out of here if you raise your hand. Really?
Yes. Well, I mean, is this something that obviously this is a San Francisco or Bay Area audience, but I mean, it would.
Well, people keep raising the Henry Ford example.
Yeah.
That's the one. That Henry Ford took his factory workers and paid them $5 a day. And at the time, it was outrageous. It was, and people said, this will be the death of your company. This is the end of it. And in fact, he went on to unprecedented success. These companies who pay a little bit more are finding they're keeping their good employees. Morale is higher. There are benefits. It's a little theoretical is the problem. And there's part of it that just says we don't want to give away more money than we have to, but there are benefits.
You know, I've really been wrestling with this for weeks now. And I've supported raises in the minimum wage at times, and there were times I've thought it was a bad idea. I thought it was a bad idea for California to do it, considering how high our unemployment has been in this state. But as it turns out, we haven't really had a problem from doing it. So in terms of, since we're talking about big money, there's a guy named Ron Unz. He ran for governor, is a Republican in 1994, and he's pushing this measure. He wants to raise the California minimum wage to $12 an hour. He's a Republican, and he's got this argument, which is, and you know, it's funny, people always say to you, as a conservative, you shouldn't want the government to be subsidizing low-wage, hiring low-wage people. But they don't know how to frame the argument where a conservative is going, yeah, you've really marshaled it. Ron Unz is really making this great conservative argument in favor of raising the minimum wage. $12 may be a little too high. As we know, the cost of doing business in California is very high. It is high, and there are people who are moving their businesses or not expanding in California for that reason. But he's pushing to get this measure on the ballot in November, and I think it's going to have a really healthy debate about what's good on the minimum wage for this state, whatever happens.
What's fascinating about his argument, you're right, it's a conservative argument, and it's well done. He says, government, well, we're going to save money on this. We're going to save money in the end because there will be less government subsidies, payments, food stamps, whatever, to people who are now making $12 an hour or more. And so if you look at the big picture of this, you say, oh, wow, we're going to pay more here, but we're going to save a lot more there. I haven't put pencil to paper on this, but if he's right, it's going to really make it difficult for people to oppose it. Now, how many people are going to really understand that argument? I don't know, but it's a very well-constructed argument.
And the CBO just came out with a report this week that it was great ammunition for this. And it basically said, there are people who get hurt when you raise the minimum wage. 500,000 people will lose 500,000 jobs will disappear. And that is a bad thing, and that's hard for people. Yes. People with small businesses, this can make a difference to whether or not they hire. But 16.5 million people will make more money if we raise the minimum wage to $10.10 per hour. And that does mean lifting people out of poverty, putting some families above the federal poverty level. That means less reliance on the earned income tax credit is a way to making work pay. It means some people will get priced out of, they'll be weaned off of welfare programs because it makes more sense for them to work. I listened into a White House press call on this week, and they were talking about less turnover, people have more of an incentive to work. It may well be. I'm really listening to this.
And with luck, we might begin to address this disappearing middle, too. I mean, we heard for years that manufacturing jobs, factory jobs, those jobs are going away. Well, now they've gone away. So now it is going to be a service economy in a lot of ways, and those people need to make a wage enough that they could raise a family, have a life, be a middle class family. We got to reinstate that.
And that's where
We lost 6 million jobs, manufacturing jobs, during the Great Recession. Mm. About almost 600,000 have come back.
Yeah.
Okay. But of the jobs that have come back, the pay is at a much lower rate than it was when the jobs left. So it's a double whammy. It's not only that the jobs have a trickle's come back, but so instead of making $30 an hour plus benefits at an automobile factory, you're now making 12 to 15.
Right.
And it goes on. You know, and that plus automation has been the kill. And you're right. We've got a whole training issue here. Massive, massive. We need to put billions of dollars into training people to do the kinds of jobs we can do that are needed. And that's where people don't get the picture.
And accepting that they'll take those jobs and be proud of having those jobs. I'm just taking this because this is all I can get. It's a honorable way to make a living.
Are any of you surprised that you surely saw the story, the Volkswagen plant in Tennessee where they voted not to go with the union? And apparently Volkswagen was fine with them going with the union because the worker councils and management interaction in Germany is really kind of the bedrock of their post-war success.
The workers looked at Detroit and they said, I don't think that the unions really we don't want them to do for us what they did for Detroit.
That's one part of it. There's another part of it. Bob Corker said, I heard.
Yeah. Yeah.
Senator from Tennessee. Mm-hmm. I heard that if the union is accepted,
that Volkswagen will not put on a third shift. Also, another fact, that some people said the state of Tennessee would withdraw, some people threatened to withdraw, subsidies if it was passed. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's only that the workers said, I feel bad about this because of what's going on in Detroit. I think some workers did, but when you've got those other political issues that get into it, it's hard to separate which was responsible for what.
I don't disagree.
I would also say that I think the unions are in a little bit of a time warp, and they really haven't developed. They're still very old school, and I think we've got a whole different workplace. And a lot of the issues that were so important, singing Joe Hill and marching around with a picket sign, that's not it. And the benefits, as Larry said, benefits are huge. Losing those benefits makes almost as much difference, if not more, than losing your salary. So I'd like to see a new and different kind of union that is responsive to today's workplace. I don't think we have it, and I think that might have been a factor, too.
Okay. Well, let's move to national politics. Obviously, these are national issues, but in particular, I wanted to look at some of the so-called 2016 contenders. My home state, this is not why I'm talking about it, but I just happen to be from Wisconsin, their governor, Scott Walker, a very conservative Republican. He's undergoing a bit of a death of 1,000 emails right now. In fact, 25,000 emails have been released. They were part of what's called a John Doe investigation, similar to a secret grand jury investigation of corruption when he was in a different office. The governor was not charged in that, though other folks have gone to jail as a result of it. However, there is a second John Doe investigation going on regarding his successful recall campaign. Why does this matter? He's been considered, or has been perhaps positioning himself as a 2016 Republican presidential contender. And when Chris Christie started going through some bridges troubles, Scott Walker's star began to rise, if you will, or profile at least. Deborah, what can we say about Scott Walker? And I mean, you kind of thought he was a good candidate.
I think he's really interesting as a candidate. We'll put this scandal behind for a second. But I want to say one thing. I think we've entered this period in politics where you can get away with anything and people will defend you. But you can survive any scandal at all. Bill Clinton would be the master on that. But it will work for Chris Christie's benefit and everyone else. The people are so angry at their guy getting roughed up, deservedly or not, that there will always be people who will support you no matter what you do in politics. You can survive practically anything. So, and look at Sarah Palin resigned as the governor of Alaska because she said, I'm sick of being investigated. I don't want to do it. Now, I thought she made a mistake. But you look at Scott Walker and you look at what's going on with Chris Christie, and there's a part of you that wonders, gee, who wants to do that? Scott Walker would be in my top three list of Republican candidates in 2016 because he's governor in a state with lots of Democrats. He survived a recall. And while he really got in a bad fight with labor, he didn't go to the mat as much as labor did on it. That's one of the reasons he survived the recall. For Obamacare, some Republican governors have decided that they're going to say no to all of the federal money that they could get for Medicaid, and they've really taken it to the mat. Scott Walker's looked for a more creative approach that serves the voters of his state, his constituents, and satisfies a conservative philosophy. He is somebody to watch, and the fact that he is sort of a button-down guy, you never know how people are going to feel after 4 years, but people may decide flash isn't quite what they're looking for. Governor George Duke Majan, right? We had Pete Wilson was our governor and Gray Davis. There are times when people decide that they want a low-key figure, and that it's possible it would work for him.
And there are other times they want an Austrian bodybuilder.
That's correct.
Larry, Scott Walker.
Well, I just want to say something about Scott Walker and Chris Christie. I really have a problem with this immediate presumption of guilt. It just offends the heck out of me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Walker is guilty. I don't know if Christie's guilty. I've seen a lot of he said, she said, memos flying. What was that guy, Wildstein, whatever his name is, Wildstein. There's evidence out there. Show it to me. And there's this tendency, and I think cable news drives a lot of this, but the mainstream media does too. There's this tendency to put it out there and sort of leaving the end with people feeling that he's done it. Well, maybe he has. Maybe they have. But until I see absolute proof, I assume that they haven't. And I know that offends a lot of people, but I'm sorry. That's just, to me, a really basic American value that I think we trample on day after day.
I totally agree with Liz.
Oh, this is scary. This is just not working out.
Okay.
I disagree.
I do want to say I don't particularly think Walker's a good candidate. I think he doesn't have a lot of gravitas. We can talk about that. I think he was clever with the Obamacare stuff. I'll give you credit for that, him credit. If I had to pick a favorite, a Republican candidate would be Jeb Bush. I think he'd be fabulous. I think he would. I think he could really do a lot for that party. He's smart. He's done an education overhaul. He's from a key state. He can win that state. And I think, you know, if people can get past his last name, this guy could do it all.
You know, that would mean a 2016 if he won the primary of a Bush-Clinton
I know.
Face-off.
Every time.
I can't wait.
I don't know.
I don't know if we can take that. The other thing I would say is, let's remember, it wasn't Watergate, it was the cover-up. And I think in a lot of these situations, I think Deborah's right. I mean, what happens may or may not sink you. It's how you handle it. And let's look at Chris Christie. I think there was a lot of baggage there before, a lot of people waiting to say, this guy is a bit of a horse's patoot, and he has been for years, but I never really wanted to say it, but this sounds just like Chris Christie. People lined up to say how little they liked the way he handled himself, was he a bully, those kinds of things. Hasn't happened with Scott Walker. That says something about whether he's buttoned down, maybe he's a little more reserved, but I think it's like they always say about pressure, it doesn't test character, it reveals it. And I think we're seeing that.
I'll just say, 3 days of really bad traffic on the George Washington Bridge, and I don't condone it. He says he had nothing to do with it. We haven't seen anything that's really proven to the contrary. Hell, we could make him the head of the Department of Transportation in California with that record when you look at the Bay Bridge.
You think that's an improvement? Then?
Because, I mean, it gives you a sense of proportion when you look at what's going on there. And in California, we've let people really destroy our transportation with no consequences whatsoever.
Is this about the Google buses again?
No, it's Bay Bridge. Yeah. Bay Bridge.
Well, speaking of the massive release of documents, Deborah, a treasure trove of documents and notes have been released from Diane Blair, a longtime friend of Hillary Clinton's. And so, of course, people have had fun going through these, finding things about her, ways she's reacted to things. You wrote about this at least once so far. What do you think? What have you found? What do you think this could mean for Hillary Clinton?
So this is, let me just tell you how this whole thing unfolded. Somebody interviewed Rand Paul's wife and asked her something about Hillary Clinton and the war on women, and she said basically that the way that the Clintons treated Monica Lewinsky, that was a real war on women. And then Rand Paul goes on Meet the Press, and David Gregory asked him about it, and he says, yeah, I think that's true. The next morning I'm watching, that's all I do, as you can tell, is watch news shows like this. I'm watching Morning Joe, and Mika Brzezinski is making jokes, thinking she's off air, about Rand Paul's hair. And then she comes on and she says, you know, he's got a point. It wasn't right the way Bill Clinton acted with Monica Lewinsky. And now we're back in this whole swirl about whether or not it's fair to bring it up. I don't know. I just went through a presidential race where I kept reading about what Mitt Romney did with his dog on a family vacation. And what year was it? 1980, whatever. So I think if you can bring up something like that over and over again, the way that the White House behaved during the Monica Lewinsky scandal is fair game. I've never quite believed that Hillary Clinton didn't know these things, by the way, that she really believed he had nothing to do with her. But according to Diane Blair's notes, Hillary was shocked that, and she thought maybe she herself had held some of the blame because she wasn't understanding enough about Bill.
I don't know if I can do Monica Lewinsky again, but I think there's a lot there's a concern, if I were Hillary's people, that there's Clinton fatigue, and that there's a sense that, you know, we've seen this, we've been through this. Maureen Dowd wrote something a few months ago, oh my God, now I remember what it was like to have the Clintons. You know, it's just, there are a lot to take in. Bill is, she is, our friend Tom Perkins said in the press meeting afterwards, I don't want to talk about Hillary Clinton, I don't want to discuss her. But I would say that the temperature of the room goes down 20 degrees when she walks in. So, I'm afraid that there's a perception that may be the case.
He needs a new joke writer.
Yes, he does. Or just fire him completely. Yeah. Anyway, that would be my concern if I were the Hillary Clinton people, that it, this, of all elections, this looks like one that needs a fresh face.
I think it's fair to bring up the issue. I don't think it has a lot of legs. I just don't. I mean, look, people who hate the Clintons will thrive on it, right?
So it's a good way to win the Republican primary, which is what most people think is the reason why Rand Paul said that.
It's a good reason. Didn't he call him a predator, a sexual predator, I think? Yeah. It's a good reason to certainly fire the base, okay? But I think we've realized that Republicans aren't going to win a presidential election with that base. They're just not, you know? So fine, you know, I don't believe anybody should be shut up. Do I think it's going to really resonate with mainstream America? First of all, how many years ago is this? Who is this Monica Lewinsky person anyway? You know, I mean, nobody. I just don't think it's going to resonate, and I think it could well backfire.
Easily could backfire, Larry. Yeah. But it is. It'll take up a few hours.
It's fair game.
Of talk show talk from time to time, and that's what it will be.
Yeah, I think
it helped us.
Yeah, it helped us. Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, who hasn't made up their mind one way or another on Monica Lewinsky? The problem in journalism, we always talk about what's the second question. Your first question is, what did you think about the Monica Lewinsky? Well, I thought it was terrible. Right? What's your second question? Does it have length? What would you do with that? Does that story have any place else to go? I don't think so. But I could see bringing it up, but that's not the core issue.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get to some questions here from the audience. A bit of a shift to one of Deborah's favorite topics. What is your view of the impact of Obamacare and the Silicon Valley, San Francisco area, this person writes, my mother runs an accounting firm with hundreds of small businesses as clients, and the impact on them is very large. So, thoughts?
For the high-tech companies, the effect of Obamacare, and for most of the large employers here, the effects of Obamacare have been, they have happened, they have driven up the cost of employer-provided health coverage, but not as radically as has happened with people who have small businesses, and are self-employed. These people are the canaries of Obamacare. And because of underwriting, they were able, if they were healthy, they had big problems, but if they were healthy, they could get inexpensive policies that they liked, and now they're facing, I talk to people, 10, 20 people every week now who are telling me stories about how I just talked to a guy a couple days ago, 74% increase in his premiums that he has to pay, and he's got a higher deductible. And these are people, a lot of these people are Obama voters. They feel completely betrayed that the president had said, if you like your health plan, you can keep it, because they found out they can't. And they are angry, and they don't trust this president anymore. And that's the effect. But in terms of for the big employers in Silicon Valley, they can absorb the small businesses and families can't absorb this. They can absorb it.
Okay. There's obviously always that talk when we talk about the minimum wage that if you raise it, it'll cost X number of jobs. Someone suggests, I'm not sure if this is a tongue-in-cheek or not, but let's reduce the minimum wage to $5 an hour. That will create lots of new jobs, right?
Right. That's the tautology. Right. The opposite is true. Yeah.
Well, look, I mean, you know, let's be honest here. Milton Friedman, long ago, wrote, there should be no minimum wage. You know, that everything should be worked out between the employer and the employee, and if it's high, it's high. If it's low, it's low. You know, of course, he said kids should drop out of school, too, if they want. So, I mean, you know, it's always a question of what government should do or not do. You know, what role should government have? That's the fundamental question. And then we go from there.
Though I would also add Germany, which is by no means a laissez-faire libertarian economy, has no minimum wage. That might change under the new coalition government, but there you have it. Okay, so This is referring to New York Mayor, I forget his first name.
Bill
de Blasio. It asks about, do you have any thoughts on Mayor Bill de Blasio's politics regarding charter schools? That's obviously a super hot topic in some communities. I don't know if it's particularly kicked around much here. Any thoughts on...
I don't want him to shut down the carriages in Central Park.
The horse-drawn carriages.
Do people know what you're talking about here?
I don't think the horses are mistreated.
There's a controversy in New York about whether the horses pulling the carriages through Central Park are being mistreated. Is it a ballot measure? Is that what it's gone to?
I don't think
executive authority.
But it did result in a lot of reporters going down and looking into the eyes of horses and saying, are you being mistreated or not?
And they said, nay.
Nay.
Okay. Do big companies have any role to play in offering full-time jobs with benefits? Do they, I guess, in the sense that they're larger, I mean, can we expect them as part of their roles in society to...
Here's the deal on this, and as I said, I'm writing on this right now, so it's so fresh in my head, it's not funny. Yes, of course, historically they have, but what we're finding with the resurgence of jobs now after the Great Depression, that a sizable percentage, I want to say 25%, that's what's rattling in my head, of new hires right now are temporary full-time employees. So one of the subtle shifts post-Great Recession is not just lower salaries for the same jobs, but jobs that don't have the permanence that they used to have. And this is part of the gestalt, if you will, that I think is underlying the uncertainty and the tentative feelings that we have in American society.
Well, not to go back to, this isn't Google buses, but the San Francisco model, again, I have heard in the last 2 weeks three different people tell me, you know, I read the other day that these tech guys start right out of school and they make, and every time I've heard it, the salary has gone up. It's been $100,000, $120,000, $100,000. Last guy told me they make $150,000 right out of school. But if you look at the statistics from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you find that millennials, the employment rate is going down, down, down. The majority of those guys are having a difficult time finding a job. And they end up, as the New York Times just had a story this last weekend, in a series of internships that either pay nothing or pay very little. At the end of 6 months, they say, I'm sorry, we'd love to hire you, but we can't do it. It's a very tough job market, and it also fuels, I think, this whole class struggle.
Okay. Someone writes, I agree that improving mid-market in San Francisco, the mid-market area, is a good idea, and tax breaks have helped to do this. But what about homelessness, drug addicts, and the mentally ill? Won't they just relocate without direct help? And before I throw that to you, I would just say when former Mayor Gavin Newsom was still mayor, he was kind of asked that sort of a question. And he said, well, the challenge is that's where the services are for those folks. And, you know, good luck getting that moved into other neighborhoods. So,
yeah, well, there's so many moving pieces to it, but that's a great one, is that the idea that we would, first of all, that we parole so many people to the Tenderloin. And in the Tenderloin, we have all the services. So if you're serious about getting yourself clean and sober, if you're getting mental assistance, you have to be in the Tenderloin to do it, which also happens to be an open-air drug bazaar. You know, there are so many catch-22s to that. And the other factor is about 16% of the people who are homeless cause 80% of the problems. And by problems, I mean visits to the emergency room, being picked up. We had a guy, we wrote a story once on the Million Dollar Man. He had racked up over $1 million in 1 year in medical costs and city costs for picking him up because it was required to take him in an ambulance. He had to go to the emergency room. He had to stay a certain amount of time. Obviously, he had no money. We are handling that so poorly. It's kind of sad to see. We just talked to the district attorney yesterday, and one of the things he mentioned was in a lot of cities they do a thing called conservatorships. This is a case where the families say, my son, my daughter, is a danger to herself and others. We need to get her into care, and if necessary, we need to require her to go into care. But, as the DA said, in San Francisco, it's extremely difficult to do that, not because the law is any different, but because we're so litigious. And we are so convinced, God bless us, we want to think the best of everyone, but it is very difficult to get through a court case and have a conservatorship. So we end up with a revolving door of people going back and forth. I guess I got off on a kind of a rant here today. It's kind of a revolving door, these people in mid-market. And it crushes your heart to see it, to walk by those people every single day. It's just very hard.
And I'm going to give a cold-hearted response. If they move someplace else, you don't want it in front of your doorstep. You don't want to spend your life savings to buy a home, and then when you walk out the door, you have to walk over someone. I go to New York, and I do not see the problem with the homeless that I see in San Francisco. So I know that there are people who worry about what will happen to the homeless if we try to make it more difficult for them to sleep on the streets here. I'll just say that I'd prefer that they do it someplace else. I mean, we have so many services, as Chuck said, to help people out who really want to be helped. I think that, you know, we need to do more things to make this city more livable for people who contribute more and basically are not antisocial.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to cut it off there. And since we have one thing in between you and our social hour, and that is our news quiz. So
uh-oh.
I'm going to ask a question. If you think you know the answer, please raise your hand. I'll call you out, and you can answer it, hopefully correctly, and you'll get a little prize. Is Robert my runner here? Robert will actually deliver it. So
okay. Chuck's going to help you.
I'll help you.
He's going to be Vanna White.
Bye-bye.
Okay. First question. Who said the United States' reaction to the events in the Ukraine show that Obama is the, quote, most naive president in history, unquote? Ma'am, I saw your hand first. That is correct. Could you deliver that to, he says, John McCain of Arizona. What did a Florida artist do to express his anger over a museum's exhibit choices? Did anyone see this story?
Oh,
and
God.
Sir, standing in the back, I saw you first. That's correct. He broke a million-dollar vase by Chinese dissident artist Ai Weiwei. Yeah. A truce between anti-government protesters and government forces broke down in what country's capital? Sir, I saw your hand first. Yes, you, sir. Ukraine? That's correct. Did you see him?
Don't say the Ukraine.
That's right.
Real
that,
offended by that.
Unless, yeah.
The protesters.
Okay. We'll be interested to see if anyone can get this one. Clerics in the United Arab Emirates issued a religious ruling that forbids Muslims to live where?
The Mission District.
No. Anyone know? She says on Mars. Could that be true? It's true.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Thank you for actually knowing that one. Okay.
Wow.
Former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, if you remember him, he's back in the news. Who did he say wrote the U.S. Constitution?
Oh, geez.
You're actually very close, Larry. Does anyone know? Take a guess. Tom DeLay, sir? No. No, sorry.
Good guess.
Not George Washington. No. You're actually answering with logical choices. Who or what did he say? Ma'am.
Jesus Christ.
God, and we'll give that to you. we'll be Trinitarian here. Okay. Yes, he said that God wrote the Constitution, and we've apparently forgotten that. Investor and entrepreneur Elon Musk confirmed this week that his Tesla electric car company was in talks with whom?
Oh, look at this.
Who said Apple? I'm sorry. I'm good. Ma'am, in the second row right there.
Discipline's breaking down here.
Yes. Raise your hand. What did Facebook buy for $19 billion, young man?
WhatsApp.
That's correct.
$19 billion.
How many more do we have?
Two.
Okay, two more quick questions. In his new budget proposal, President Obama removed a planned reduction for what?
You didn't even finish the
right question. In the back there, you were Social Security. That is correct.
Oh.
And for our last one, okay, who slammed Republican Senate leaders for, quote, trickery, unquote, in the debt ceiling vote that they held just last week. Who said that? Sir?
Ted Cruz.
That's right. Republican Senator Ted Cruz slammed his own party's leaders. Well, we'll have more news quiz questions and much more to discuss on Friday, March 14th, when we return for our next week-to-week political roundtable at the Commonwealth Club. Thank you to Deborah J. Saunders, Dr. Larry Gerson, C.W. Negus. Thank you all of you for here, coming out, and everyone listening on watching TV. Have a great weekend.